Question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, November 29th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
An update on Occupy Los Angeles and Occupy UC. U.S.-Pakistan relations reach a breaking point after a fatal U.S. airstrike, an analysis of Congo's elections, and this week's Civic Circus with Ankur Patel.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. It has been more than 24 hours since the deadline for Occupy LA activists to vacate their tent city in front of City Hall. A standoff with LAPD officers early on Monday morning that resulted in the police leaving energized the movement. Some protesters filed a federal injunction yesterday based on a violation of their civil rights. The injunction names L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, LAPD Chief Charlie Beck, and the City of Los Angeles, and has requested a court order to stop the eviction of the nearly three-month-old encampment that housed 500 tents at its peak and is now down to about 300. According to Reuters, last night was more subdued than Sunday night, and, quote, small clusters of officers stood by casually at various intersections on the fringes of the park with no imminent sign of large-scale police action, end of quote. It is suspected that police action may come after December 1st, when homeless shelters open for the winter and could draw away transient occupiers from City Hall. Meanwhile, yesterday was also a day of action across the state of California, as students and staff of several UC campuses disrupted the Board of Regents meeting. The meeting was held at four UC campuses, UCLA, UC San Francisco, UC Davis, and UC Merced, where regents met via teleconference. However, groups of students on all four campuses protested with chants and forced those meeting to move elsewhere. An extended public comment period provided a forum for students to lodge their complaints about the ongoing tuition hikes approved by officials who make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in salaries and allowances, as well as about the recent unprovoked police pepper spraying of peaceful protesters at UC Davis. The group Refund California worked with students on UC campuses to push for education funding through taxing wealthy corporations and banks. A little bit later, we'll be joined by a student from UCLA. But first, Bree Gonzalez joins me. She's a member of Occupy Los Angeles and has been at the encampment since the first week of the encampment. She was camped out overnight on Sunday through the General Assembly yesterday evening. Welcome to Uprising, Bree.
Hello, how are you?
Doing very well, and thanks so much for joining us. Well, first of all, what was discussed yesterday at the General Assembly? What was the main topic now that it seems as though the police have temporarily at least backed off from forcibly evicting protesters?
Yeah, we all have this open dialogue in regards to different tactics we're planning on using and what's next for the occupation. And most definitely, it's all about open dialogue, even with our police department. So yesterday was a lot of just discussing with people, and I think that's the main point, is to have that open dialogue with everyone, just to get our point across and see what's next.
And so what about this federal injunction that has been filed and that says that the civil rights of protesters have been violated? It's based on the fact that the city council passed a resolution supporting Occupy LA, but now the city wants to evict the protesters. And also the city has made exemptions to other or exceptions to other instances where people want to camp overnight, for example, when people camped out on the sidewalks of Westwood Village for several days to be first in line for the midnight showing of the first Twilight sequel. So the city can make exceptions. Is this federal injunction going to make a difference?
You know, I really do hope so. And, you know, Black Friday happens. People camp out, you know, to shop the next day.
That's right.
There are people camping out for these movies. And, you know, then we have people that are there fighting for our rights. You know, what's interesting, you know, I had this great conversation yesterday with all the women of Occupy that I love dearly. And what's interesting is we're out there fighting for our rights. We're learning. We're educating ourselves. And that's the point. You know, when you're looking at the media, when you're watching TV, you're not there. You're not getting the experience of your friends. So it's when your friends are there and you have any family or anyone that you know, you're getting a first-hand basis off of what's happening there and what's being discussed. So I really do think that, you know, it is going to pass. We are going to be able to have a voice in that. And I really do hope so, because it's our right to be there. It's our right to have that voice. We're having an open dialogue about our future. Why isn't that in place? Why aren't we doing this? And now we are, which is great. I also had a discussion. We had these police officers that came by. We were outside of Starbucks all just talking. We were there from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. after, you know, without any sleep. You know, we're just motivated to discuss our future. And these police officers came by, and I spoke to Officer David Krumer, and, you know, basically just talking about everything, corporations, personhood, you know, and how we want them to lose that. It's not fair. And, you know, discussing everything and getting a personal opinion from these police officers, actually having that dialogue was amazing. And, you know, I asked him, you know, what is it going to take for us to have that, you know, discussion with you guys on a personal level, where it's not, you know, where I don't have to go to the liaison to get a hold of, you know, a media person to discuss, you know, what's going to happen between the PD and the occupiers. Why aren't we just talking to each other? So, you know, we actually had several police officers come to the camp yesterday during the General Assembly, just discussing about how everything was very chill last night.
And did they come as individuals, or did they come as in their capacity as police officers?
Last night at the J.A., they came as police officers, not as individuals. Mm-hmm. But definitely at Starbucks, they were individuals. We stopped them from going in and buying and actually talked to us for a good 30 minutes, and then proceeded to go into Starbucks and buy their coffee, you know. And that was awesome. And, you know, I think there needs to be that dialogue, not only with the police department, but, you know, continually asking that from our city council members. And we have, you know, we've asked the mayor to come to the General Assemblies, and with no response. And, you know, that's frustrating for us. All we want is dialogue to happen between occupiers and, you know, the rest of the 99% and even the 1%. We want to know what's going on. That's the point of this whole occupation, is to continue to educate and be educated. I am going out there to educate myself every single day. And, you know, I love it. I meet people and discuss everything. I mean, yesterday we even talked about self-defense as a woman. And we ended up doing a little, you know, self-defense thing. You know, they're outside of Starbucks teaching each other how to defend each other as a woman, you know. And it's wonderful. I mean, that's empowering, you know?
Well, Bree Gonzalez, let's talk about the mayor very briefly. He had shown a lot of support, verbal support for the occupiers, going as far as distributing raincoats, ponchos to the occupiers when it rained early on in the encampment. And now has turned around and said that because of health and safety concerns, that the encampment does need to go. However, he's said that he still supports the spirit of the occupation. Do you take that seriously? Do you think the mayor's being sincere?
You know, I think the mayor has a certain, you know, he's got to look at it from a media perspective. I mean, he's got eyes on him in regards to, like, will you support us? Yeah, the 99%. I do not think that he is actually for the movement. I think that's all talk. I mean, in my personal opinion, he just wants a vote.
So you're saying he's just being a politician?
I think he is definitely being a politician. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's information out there that he, instead of spending $1 million on our homeless in L.A., ended up giving it to his friends. And you know, building, you know, whatever they used it for. And that's just That's frustrating.
Well, finally, let me ask you about the future of the encampment, not the future of the movement itself, because it seems as though this movement can't be stopped. But in terms of the physical encampment at City Hall, Reuters is saying, and I quote, "Occupy campers seemed resigned to the fact that their 8-week-old presence was nearing an end." Also, the number of tents has gone down from almost 500 to a little under 300. What do you think the future of this tent city is going to be?
You know, the minute I heard there was going to be an eviction, I moved my tent. I moved my stuff. From seeing what happened all over the country and in different occupations, it's clear that there's a possibility of our stuff being damaged, of being ruined. I mean, in New York, like, I believe 4,500, if not more, books were destroyed or damaged. And, I mean, that's insane. That's our property. You know, we come here and bring our stuff. We set up a camp. And then after over several times, you know, it becomes a home to us. We're there to learn and debate, and it becomes a home. And so, you know, I moved my stuff immediately. The minute I heard there might be an eviction, I don't want any of my stuff ruined.
Mm-hmm.
I took everything back. But the reason why there aren't as many tents is because everyone decided, okay, we got to take our stuff back so that we have stuff to reoccupy, if that be the matter. And there are discussions of are we going to stay there? Will we move? And, I mean, personally, I think that there's plenty of public spaces all around L.A. to occupy, and there's plenty of places for us to have open dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's also a lot of transients that were there that moved out, you know, and obviously they're going back to what they're comfortable with. And I'm sure we're there to help support the movement. You know, I've met a lot of transients that are extremely smart and, came there and had some sort of sustainability there, you know, rather than in, you know, the, you know, Sixth Street or and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's right. been a home for several people, and that I think that's what's frustrating to us is we were actually getting some form of sustainability there, and then it's like coming in and evicting us. It just. It doesn't help anything.
Well, Bree, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we do want to have you back on to join us again to let us know what is happening there. Best of luck to you, and thanks so much for the update.
Thank you.
Bree Gonzalez is one of the occupiers down at City Hall. Well, she has been there since the first week of the encampment and camped out through till yesterday evening, where she sat in on the General Assembly. In a little bit, we're going to speak with Kyle Arnon, who is a fifth-year PhD student at UCLA, about the day of action at UC campuses yesterday. But before we do that, I want to play for you a short report filed by KPFK's Jonathan Alexander, who has also been an intimate part of the Occupy Los Angeles encampment. And he was there on Sunday night when it was thought that protesters might be forcibly evicted by the police. Instead, the police left and protesters celebrated. Here is a little tidbit of, or a little taste of what Sunday night through Monday morning was like at City Hall.
So I'm going to be here until the sun rises, at least.
Everyone start backing up. Just back it up.
Thank you.
And the two trucks with the officers were on them and leaving. Everybody broke out in a song. How sweet that was. I got 2 hours sleep on the sidewalk. Oh, my goodness.
Was it worth it?
I'm 72 years old, and I wouldn't miss this for anything.
Are you going to be back here tomorrow night?
I'll be back here tonight.
Tonight, tonight.
I'm going home and sleep, and then I'll be back, yeah.
Daniel, how does it feel to be here as the sun's coming up this morning?
Surprising one, but it feels good. I mean, there are a whole lot more people than I expected show up last night, and like hundreds, maybe even thousands more than I thought actually stayed the entire night.
going to be here tomorrow night?
As long as it takes.
How does it feel to watch the cops roll off as the sun comes up?
Oh, it's wonderful. We were really, really ecstatic about all the support that we got. We estimated somewhere between 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. It was a lot of support that we got from the general public, which we really, really appreciate. And we're going to do the best to represent them the best way possible by staying here, being nonviolent, and trying to really get to the issues at hand so that we can move this movement forward,
nice.
Which is something we've had a difficult time with, but I think at some juncture we're going to be able to get it together and move forward.
And that was a special report filed for Uprising by Jonathan Alexander here at KPFK. As I mentioned earlier, yesterday was a day of action for UC students across the state of California. A meeting of the UC Board of Regents that took place at four UC campuses via teleconference was disrupted. Kyle Arnon is a fifth-year PhD student at UCLA. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Kyle.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Well, first, tell us exactly what happened yesterday. I understand students participated in a 90-minute-long public comment section, but at least on a couple of campuses forced those who are participating in the meeting, the regents participating in the meeting, to move.
Yeah, the short story is that the public comment section was initially planned for 20 minutes, and then the regents extended it to an hour, and then during the course of the public comment section yesterday, they actually extended it to an hour and a half. After the public comment session ended, students at Merced disrupted the meeting by engaging in a mic check, which is a sort of tactic that was developed by Occupy Wall Street protesters. And that mic check was shortly followed by mic checks at UC San Francisco, UC Davis, and UCLA, which made it virtually impossible for the regents to conduct a meeting via teleconference over the protesters' noise.
Well, I understand there were two main issues here. One was the police brutality on campus, as exemplified in the pepper spraying of peaceful protesters at UC Davis recently, in a video that has gone viral and been viewed by millions around the country and the world. But the other issue, perhaps a longer-term issue, is that of planned tuition hikes. It's already quite expensive for UC students to attend, and there are more hikes being planned. What alternative did students present to the Board of Regents, who usually throw up their hands in the air and say, our hands are tied because the state's cutting our budget?
Sure, and they've taken that position for a long time. And I think the most revealing event in the last few months came in November, earlier this month. So in September, there was a plan for an 8% to 14% tuition increase over the next 4 years, or each year over the next 4 years, which would have amounted to an 81% tuition increase over 4 years. And in early November, in response to mobilizing students, President Udall actually reversed that policy and then decided that he was going to ask the state for $411 million to refund public education. So you would think that that would be a victory for students, but the problem with this new proposal is that he doesn't actually have any concrete plans for exactly how they're going to get that money to the UC. And he's even publicly acknowledged, as far as I can tell, in the LA Times, that he doesn't actually expect the state to grant him the $411 million.
Hmm.
So my interpretation of that is that it was simply political cover, and that they can take the same stance that they've taken for the last several years, which is that we asked the state for money, they denied us, and so what other option do we have other than to raise tuition once again?
Do you feel that this is more of an ideological battle, that the UC system's power elite, if you will, those who run it, would like to see a privatized education system, that because even though this is a state university system that should have been providing free or nearly free education to its students, to the students of California, we're now seeing a sort of ideological battle about whether or not Californians have the right to affordable, free, accessible public higher education?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly ideology embedded in the entire struggle, but I think more importantly is the sort of political actions of the regents themselves. Somewhere along the way over the last 40 or 50 years, it was decided that bankers, real estate developers, and corporate elite should somehow fill the positions on the Board of Regents. Of the 19 appointed regents, only one of them has prior experience as an educator or as an administrator of a public education institution.
So most of them are part of the 1%, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, in short, they're part of the 1%. And then one is a student, and the other 17 are corporate and financial elite. And so they partly conceived of themselves not as political actors, but as just functionaries. And so the last several years, they've acted like businessmen would act. They sort of evaluate their expenses, and they evaluate their revenue, and they increase fees accordingly, rather than conceiving of themselves as political actors and appealing to the state to find new sources of tax revenue in a serious way. They've obviously made it clear publicly that they support these new sources of tax revenue, but they've refused to sign the Refund California Pledge, which students and supporters have put forward to them, which has several concrete proposals to increase tax revenue to refund public education in California. Mm.
Finally, Kyle, the protests of and organizing of state university system students, both at the UC and CSUs in California, has long predated the Occupy movement. But how has the adoption of Occupy tactics and the emergence of this broader movement energized the struggles of students?
I really like this question. I've been asked a couple times, so I thought about it pretty carefully. Mm-hmm. I think that obviously there's just a sort of, in general, a much more favorable sort of social environment for protest in the U.S., but I think that the real genius of the Occupy movement so far is the tents. I think the tents matter for a couple of reasons. One is that they have a sort of ambiguous legal status, and they're almost... And you can almost ignore them as well. They're sort of a form of nonviolent direct action civil disobedience without being an enormous threat. So the authorities are forced to address it, but when they crack down on occupiers setting up tents, it seems very excessive. And so this tactic has actually forced authorities, not only in the Occupy movements in several urban spaces, but on campuses, as we saw at Davis and Berkeley, to respond with force. And as much as we hate seeing students beaten with batons or pepper sprayed, the excessive police force has put the UC student movement at the center of the Occupy movement nationwide.
Well, Kyle Arnon, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and best of luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kyle Arnon is a fifth-year PhD student at UCLA involved in the struggle of UC students to take back their university education system. This is Uprising, and up next you'll hear this week's Civic Circus with Ankur Patel, and then we'll go to Pakistan, from there to Congo. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Civic Circus. I'm Ankur Patel, breaking down local politics, going to three-hour meetings so you don't have to. This week on Uprising, I'm going to give you a report on the municipal elections held on November 8th. Some people may have already forgotten what they voted for, and based on the 13.8% voter turnout, here's a little bit of a background. With over 500 political districts and 4,300,000 registered voters, Los Angeles County is some of the most complicated political geography in the country. With federal, state, county, and city government already confusing enough to most people, we have to remember school and water districts have their own elected officials as well. There were 82 elected bodies in Los Angeles County holding some sort of election on November 8th, 6 community colleges, 14 elementary school districts, 4 high school districts, 28 unified school districts, 10 water districts, and 20 different cities, all electing different positions from city councilman and school board member to mayor. To give a bird's eye view, the size of the cities in terms of registered voters ranges widely, from Hawaiian Gardens with their 4,042 registered voters to Palmdale City with almost 60,000 registered voters. But again, the county as a whole saw voter turnout of 13.8%. One of the elections that did stand out was El Monte, as its 32,856 registered voters turned out to vote at a phenomenal clip of 32.1%. In the spirited campaign for city council, 6 candidates were separated by a few hundred votes, and in an election where 22,000 people did not exercise their ability to vote, the difference between first and second place was only 7 votes. But let's focus on the million-dollar race for the billion-dollar seat in Los Angeles City Council District 15, CD 15. That race saw 15 separate candidates raise money, 11 of which actually qualified for the ballot. Even though November 8th was just the primary, the candidates have already spent a combined $1,400,000, while an additional $596,000 in independent expenditures has been made for this seat that has jurisdiction over the Port of Los Angeles. The truly amazing part of the election was the fact that this $2 million campaign saw only 18,247 ballots cast. That's over $100 per vote. The two candidates that will square up in the general election are Warren Furutani, who used $313,000 to get 4,098 votes. That's $76 a vote. And the other candidate, Joe Buscaino, who used $264,000 and benefited from $147,000 in independent expenditures, took 5,175 votes. Independent expenditures make it more difficult to calculate who's running the most efficient campaign, but there were clearly some inefficient campaigns like Pat McCosker's, which had a total of $619,000 spent on its behalf and earned 1,779 votes. That's $348 a vote. Getting money out of politics is important, but the fact of the matter is that we don't vote. There were a total of 226,966 ballots cast out of a possible 1,645,524 in Los Angeles County. That's a voter turnout of 13.8%. Perhaps at the presidential level, the term peanut gallery is befitting, but the city council and the state legislature are occupiable. For Uprising, I'm Ankur Patel with Civic Circus.
Thanks, Ankur. Before we go to our next story, I just want to remind listeners, tomorrow is going to be the first of Uprising's speaker series featuring Dr. Gabor Mate, the acclaimed physician and best-selling author. He's going to be speaking at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, zip code 90005. We're very excited about it. We hope all of you can make it. If you pledged for tickets during the KPFK Fun Drive, your names will be at will call. Tickets are available still at uprisingradio.org. But they're going fast. We will have limited numbers of tickets available at the door. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. There will be parking available for $3 at the UTLA parking lot across the street. Do bring exact change. Again, that's tomorrow evening, the Gabor Mate event. The reception, a pre-event reception, is at 6 p.m. and the actual event starts at 7 p.m. Both options are available for tickets at uprisingradio.org. The Pakistani government has decided to permanently cut off NATO's supply route for its Afghanistan war effort after U.S. airstrikes killed over two dozen Pakistani soldiers near the border over the weekend. It is not yet clear what the move will do to the American war effort. Nearly half of all war supplies for the almost 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan go through Pakistan. The U.S.'s South Asian ally has also given U.S. troops a two-week deadline to vacate a base used by the CIA to launch unmanned drone strikes in the northwest frontier province. A third potential casualty of the attacks is Pakistan's threat to suspend its role in talks between the U.S., Afghanistan, the Taliban, and Pakistani militant groups. The U.S. strikes in question were aimed at two Pakistani observation posts in the Mohmand tribal area. NATO is claiming that the weekend's fatalities were caused by a response to a shot from the Pakistani border bases, but Pakistani officials denied those claims, saying that the U.S. attack was unprovoked and that their military installations were clearly marked. The Los Angeles Times reported that, quote, Pakistan's army spokesman, Major General Athar Abbas, said the Pakistani military tried to alert coalition forces that their gunships were firing on Pakistani army posts, but the attack continued. The deaths of the soldiers have touched off a nerve among the Pakistani public, who have become increasingly skeptical of their nation's relationship with the U.S. Pakistan's leading English-language newspaper, The Daily Times, editorialized that, quote, U.S. and NATO forces have routinely made it a matter of policy to do as they please and then apologize and move on. Pakistani officials have tallied more than 70 Pakistani troop casualties as a result of U.S. strikes over the past 3 years, but civilian casualties of the strikes are even greater in number. White House spokesman Jay Carney on Monday called the attacks a tragedy and pledged an investigation. My guest is Fred Branfman. He is an independent journalist and author of over a dozen articles on the dangers to U.S. security posed by the U.S.'s actions in Pakistan. His work regularly appears in Alternate, Truthdig, and Salon, and he now joins us from Budapest. Welcome to Uprising, Fred.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, do you look at what this, what these attacks have done to U.S.-Pakistani relations as sort of the nail in the coffin of U.S.-Pakistan ties?
Not at this point. The Pakistani military still needs its $2 billion a year from the United States. So I wouldn't say that this is the end. And, you know, last time they suspended, they stopped the trucks going into Afghanistan for a couple of weeks, and then they started them up again. So I wouldn't say it's a nail in the coffin at this point in the very short term. But I do think that the present U.S. policy towards Pakistan is endangering United States national security. And that unless we stop, we may well get many, we may get some nuclear nails in the coffin over the next decade.
Well, certainly Pakistan is a nuclear power, but there's an issue of the U.S.'s relationship with the Pakistani government and the military. And then there is the public sentiment in Pakistan. And sometimes the Pakistani leadership echoes that public sentiment because, of course, they want to remain in power. But secret cables that were leaked by WikiLeaks recently showed that the Army Chief of Pakistan, Ashfaq Pervez Kayani, not only agreed to the U.S. drone flights, but he actually requested for the Americans to increase them in 2008. And publicly, of course, they decry the effects of these attacks. Is the Pakistani leadership playing playing both sides of this war?
Well, I think they're playing a triple game. I mean, they want the money. They want the Taliban to win in Afghanistan. They're just hedging their bets. I have nothing good to say about the Pakistani military. I think, you know, they have to be there the rest of their lives, and if the Taliban win, they want to be on the side of the Taliban. But I don't think that's the issue for the United States. I think the question for the United States is very simple. Number one, should we be in Afghanistan? I don't think we should. I think it's the greatest foreign policy mistake of my lifetime to waste $1 trillion in Pakistan at the very time that the Chinese are spending $1 trillion to dominate the clean energy economy of the future. However, even if you want to be, if you think the United States should be in Afghanistan, and don't forget now we've been fighting there 10 years and the violence is up, not down. But even if you think we should be there, Afghanistan is a country of 30 million people. Pakistan is a country of 180 million people with nuclear bombs. I believe the single biggest mistake we're making right now is to extend the war into Pakistan to try and win in tiny Afghanistan. This is insane. We should be doing everything possible not to be doing any warfare in Pakistan. For several reasons. First of all, there's a growing likelihood of a military coup in Pakistan. It's been openly discussed on the front page of the New York Times, which would be a disaster for U.S. foreign policy to have an anti-U.S. government take over in Pakistan, which is always a possibility, particularly if China decides to give them the aid that they're now getting from the United States. Secondly, and most importantly, and I'm glad you mentioned the WikiLeaks cables, in there, it was revealed that our own ambassador is terrified that nuclear materials is going to fall into the hands of terrorists from Pakistan's nuclear stockpile, which is the world's fastest growing and the world's least secure nuclear stockpile. This is a very serious matter, and actually the public opinion and the behavior of the Pakistani military and government are related, when you get to nuclear weapons, what our former ambassador, Ann Patterson, said in the WikiLeaks cables was, the government is refusing to cooperate with us on safeguarding their nuclear weapons because the public hates us so much, and that is, hates the United States so much, that they would believe if the government started to cooperate that the U.S. wanted to steal Pakistan's nuclear weapons. So public opinion, this is according to our own ambassador, so public opinion in Pakistan is extremely important. And what is the public opinion in Pakistan? 69% of the Pakistani people, that's 125 million human beings, regard the United States as their enemy. This is a Pew poll from about 6 months ago. Now, think about that. I mean, if there was another 911 in this country, obviously the most likely place it would come from would either be from people within Pakistan who hate us, or let's say Pakistanis in London. David Cameron said a few years ago, again we know from WikiLeaks, he said that Pakistanis in London and in Great Britain have been radicalized by the United States invasion of Iraq. Pakistanis in Great Britain have, British passports, many of them. These are very serious issues, and our leaders don't have a clue. I mean, American leaders are making, in my opinion, the biggest mistake of our lifetime to be waging war in Pakistan. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, what do you think the impact of Pakistan's decision to boycott the upcoming Bonn conference will be? This is the conference that's to be held on the 10th anniversary of a conference held in the same place, Bonn, Germany, after the U.S. Defeated the Taliban when it first, just a few months after it launched its war in Afghanistan. But this time around, there was to be participation by Pakistan, which was at least, in looking at it simplistically, was an important aspect given Pakistan's role in supporting the Taliban over the years. If Pakistan is going to back off from this conference, can it have a greater impact on the stability of Afghanistan and the future of the U.S. role in Afghanistan? Could it lengthen the U.S.'s war there?
Well, I hate to be cynical, but I've never seen these conferences accomplish anything. I think the more important matter is that this will increase sentiment within Pakistan for supporting the Taliban. It increases support within Pakistan for attacking Karzai's government. Don't forget, it was the Afghani. These are CIA units run by Americans with local Afghanis that called in the airstrikes on the Pakistani airbase, and all it will do is help the Taliban. The conference itself, it's hard for me to take them seriously. I think basically everybody's waiting. I mean, the people out there are waiting till 2014. They're waiting for the U.S. to leave, and then the Taliban, of course, would at that point hope to take power. And the Pakistani government is going, well, look, we've got to live with these people for the rest of time. Therefore, we want to continue to support them. I don't think it's our business, actually. I mean, I think the thing to remember is the justification for both the war in Afghanistan and the war in Pakistan is a U.S. war making in Pakistan. Is to defeat al-Qaeda so they won't attack the United States. Well, as you know, last week the CIA and the Pentagon announced there's only two al-Qaeda people left, El-Zawahiri and a few, and one other, in terms of leadership.
Right.
They've accomplished their supposed goal. But in the course of defeating al-Qaeda, which was never more than, maybe 1,000 people, they've created tens of thousands of new potential suicide bombers within Pakistan, people who would like nothing better than to kill Americans because we've killed so many of them with our drone strikes. We've killed 2,500 Pakistanis with our drone strikes officially, of whom they can only name 56 as either Taliban or al-Qaeda leaders.
And,
90% of the,
And when you talk about the militant groups within Pakistan, are you referring to the Haqqani network and the group that's referred to often as the Pakistani Taliban?
Well, that's one of the groups that they keep building up. But there's dozens of anti-government the forces within Pakistan. The Haqqani network is the one that's best known. But the point is, they don't know who they're killing. They can only name 56 people. They've killed thousands of people on the grounds that they were near some Taliban training camp or whatever. We, the public, are not allowed to know what the criteria are for who they're bombing, but we do know that they can't name who they are, and we do know that a number of human rights groups have found that we've murdered hundreds and hundreds of civilians, including dozens and dozens of children, with these drone strikes. Now, again, I believe this is criminal, personally. I don't think we have any right to be killing unarmed suspects without giving them any right to defend themselves on the grounds that they're militants when we can't even name who they are. But that aside, the theme of my article is this is very bad for U.S. national security. It is not protecting us to kill under, let's call them, 100 militants. And the cost of that is to make hundreds of thousands of people hate us within Pakistan, in my opinion, it's endangering national security. I mean, ask yourself, if there was another 911, as I've said, where's the most likely place it's going to come from? Obviously, Pakistan. We can't possibly kill more people than we're creating. For every time we kill one of these people, we create 10 new people who want to kill us. It's absolutely the most irrational policy I've ever seen.
Well, Fred Branfman, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your insight and analysis with us.
Well, thank you.
Fred Branfman is an independent journalist and author of over a dozen articles on the dangers to U.S. security posed by the U.S.'s actions in Pakistan. His work regularly appears on Alternate, Truthdig, and Salon. He spoke with us from Budapest. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we will take a look at what's been happening in the Democratic Republic of the Congo this week. Elections happened yesterday, but voting has been extended by a second day due to violence and chaos. Stay tuned.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
The U.S. Human Rights Network National Conference and Member Meeting will be held in Los Angeles during Human Rights Weekend, December 9th through the 11th at the Radisson LAX Hotel. Malcolm X told us over 40 years ago, the struggle is for human rights. From the battle of workers in Wisconsin and Ohio to the fight back of nationwide Occupy movements, human rights activists must prepare themselves for the struggles ahead by sharpening their analysis, building broader alliances, and asserting their bold visions for a better society. Building a people-centered human rights movement is one sure path to getting there. More details are available at kpfk.org or by calling 404-588-9761. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Welcome back to Uprising. Voters in the Democratic Republic of the Congo are casting their ballots for a second day today after chaos and violence marred the polls yesterday. The DRC's election officials extended voting after widespread complaints of irregularities and poor access to the polls. Congolese are voting in presidential and parliamentary elections. At least five people were killed yesterday following at least as many deaths in election-related violence in the days leading up to the vote. The frontrunners for president used inflammatory language in the days before the election and encourage supporters not to accept defeat, raising tensions between political and ethnic groups. President Joseph Kabila is expected to beat opponent Etienne Tshisekedi, and Kabila set off alarm bells within the international human rights community when he insulted the ethnicity of his opponent, referring to his ethnic community as, quote, mosquitoes, and saying, quote, now is the time to apply insecticide. MSNBC reports that Tshisekedi, for his part, called on his supporters to break prisoners out of jails and, quote, teach Kabila's police a lesson in front of their families. The LA Times reports several polling places were burned down in the West Kasai province, an area dominated by Tshisekedi supporters. Voting in the Congo is complicated by a poor system of roads and an election infrastructure unable to easily accommodate 32 million voters. The sheer number of choices for parliament is also overwhelming, with an estimated 18,000 candidates running for just 500 seats. There is fear that if the presidential candidates or their supporters condemn the election results as rigged or flawed, the nation will slip into civil conflict. My guest is Kambale Musavuli. He is the national spokesperson and student coordinator for the group Friends of the Congo. Welcome to Uprising, Kambale.
Thanks for having me back.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, can you give our listeners a political context for these elections? How important are they?
It's very important. This is the second election coming up of the end of the second war in the Congo. And it really represents the hope of change in the Congo. And with the rising of the violence on the ground and the political discussions taking place, it's making us a little bit more afraid that we don't fall back into conflict that the Congo has witnessed for the past 16 years. So it's very important for the Congolese. We hope for change, and we hope that things will not get as bad as it is right now.
Well, what does the clash between the two leading presidential candidates represent? On the surface, it seems as though there are tensions between various ethnic communities. Is that it, or is there something deeper going on?
Yes. The way to look at what's taking place right now in the Congo is in regard of the will of the Congolese people to have change. The current president, President Kabila, who is also running for presidency, has been in power since 2001. He was voted in as a president in 2006. And not much has changed in the Congo in terms of human conditions. You know, when we look at the United Nations just this past month, they stated that the Congo is number 187 out of 187 countries in the Human Development Index. Mm-hmm. So we are at the bottom of human development. If we have to look at that. So the progress of peace, security, safety, and development hasn't taken place under this regime. So the people have been expressing their frustration in the streets. And that's where Tshisekedi comes in. Tshisekedi has been a veteran into the political arena, and he fought Mobutu for decades. He showed up in the political arena as an opposition leader in 1982, when his party was created, EDPS. And he's been still engaged now. He's now 78 now and represents an alternative to the current situation. So in the country, those are the two top contenders. And people are either voting for Kabila or Tshisekedi, one representing an alternative to the current situation, that would be Tshisekedi, and Kabila representing the current regime, meaning the status quo, which has not changed much in the lives of the Congolese people.
And I should mention that this election is only the second that has happened since the end of the last war in the Congo. And it's actually the first to be organized by the government instead of the international community. But there is there seems to be so much at stake here for ordinary Congolese. There was one news report that that discussed how ballots had to be delivered, extra ballots had to be delivered because one precinct ran out of ballots yesterday, and when they were delivered in an unmarked car, and when poll workers tried to unload the materials, a group of people rushed the car, accusing poll workers of delivering pre-marked ballots. And then police had to fire tear gas to disperse angry voters outside. And that gives a sense that there is, first of all, deep suspicion among the public that there could be vote rigging, but also a strong sense of wanting these elections to be free and fair?
Yes, I mean, not I will not only say that it's suspicion, because election observers have seen that. I can quote the wife of Senator McCain, Cindy McCain. She's in the eastern part of Congo. And when she went to the polls yesterday as an election observer, she saw a package. One of the ballot box already prepared full, and she reported that. And she said it does not make sense that the first people to vote, they are already the ballot box is already filled. And we're seeing that from east to the west. So there are already election irregularities. And the degree to which this thing is going to be exposed is what's going to also make the population not trust the process for it to not be free and fair. But all of this was predictable. It was predictable in January when the Congolese government changed the constitution, the electoral law, to make sure there is only one round of elections. Well, it was predictable when they consolidated the power, where the judicial power is not controlled by the presidency, as well as the president voting for governors. So you're seeing this process of boxes going to all these different states, where the president can fire at will any governor. Not only that, it controls the judicial process. If people have to contest the results, they will have to follow what the current regime is setting. So we do know that we are going toward a scam election. We're very concerned because we, the people, right now, before the elections, they stopped already raising these flags and they demonstrated. Now, unfortunately, some of them were shot with live bullets. Some were arrested or hurt through this protest. So it's a call to the international community to be very bold in protecting the human rights of the Congolese. We have a UN mission there that has to protect the civilians, and they're not doing so at the moment.
Let me ask you this, Kambale. You mentioned Cindy McCain, Senator John McCain's wife, being there as an election observer, and that could often, you know, raise the suspicion of progressives who don't necessarily see somebody like McCain as someone who might be interested in real democracy in Congo or might have a different motive. What is Cindy McCain doing in the Congo, and what is the role of the West in these elections?
Well, Cindy McCain has been working with Ben Affleck, with an organization called ECI. I do not have more information in regard to the political line that lies around her being an observer. On the ground, but she's not the only one. The Carter Center is on the ground as well. They have deployed observers around the country. We have the European Union there as well. And the United Nations itself have their own observers as well. We have, you know, the head of the UN mission in the Congo is Roger Meese, who is an American. The international community has been very split. They have not, when I'm going to look at it from east to west. In the West, specifically the United States and Great Britain, they have not been very supportive of this electoral process. You know, in 2006, the international community brought in $500 million to support this election. This year, they've been very silent. You know, they've been silent or did not take action on pre-election violence.
And why do you think that is the case? Why is the international community silent this year?
I can only speculate. That they did not have hope of a free and fair election this year, so they did not get engaged. But now, on the other hand, in the East, speaking of China, you know, China, South Africa, and Russia are the three countries that supported this electoral process. They've provided helicopters and planes to fly the ballot box. So South Africa printed off the ballot box, and China also financed some of the process. So we saw that, you know, when the Congolese government stated that we want this election to happen, they asked the West to support. The support did not arrive, and they turned to the East. And the East provided the support of that. Now, those now create challenges because now we have ballot boxes that with the suspicion of having stuffed ballots in the box. No, that raised concern.
Stuffed ballots.
Ballots and so on and so forth.
I see. So finally, Kambale, with the election having been extended for a second day, how long will it be before election results are known? I mean, it seems like not only is it an immense logistical challenge to have 63,000 polling places in a country with that is as poor as the Congo, but even tallying up the votes with 18,000 candidates running for 500 seats in the parliament is going to be quite a task.
It is definitely quite a task. The official results are supposed to be published on December 6th. The Electoral Commission today stated that they will have provisional results by the end of the week, and the official, of course, December 6th, which is Tuesday next week. The The issue necessarily is not them publishing the results. There is already distrust of the process from the police people themselves on the ground as they're witnessing all the challenges that I have. So the challenge will be, will the Congolese people agree to the result that will be published on December 6th? And will that be an indicator for either increased violence on the ground or engagement of the international community to make sure that the people, their human rights are not violated? Or the current regime will just resign? So those are the things to look at as we await the results. I mean, for an oppressive regime, they do not need to count. They can't publish any numbers they would like. And that's what the current regime is offering right now. So that our fear is what will happen to the people on the ground as they are rising up, just as the youth of Egypt has done, youth of Burkina Faso and other African countries, as they are organizing against an oppressive regime.
Well, Kambale, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Kambale Musavuli is the national spokesperson and student coordinator for Friends of the Congo. We've been talking about the elections that are happening in Congo. Congo is 187 out of 187 countries. It's ranked the lowest in the UN's Human Development Index for the world's nations. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Bill Moyers once said, "Democracy works when people claim it as their own." You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. You can listen to the show online, find links, local events, and other information we mention on the air at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.